Welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. This is a podcast run by artists for artists, where we talk about what it means to be one. My name's Sophia Kayafis.
I'm Marshall Jones.
And we're here with our producer,
Tun Miai.
We're three artists living and working in New York City. And this is being recorded on the fly. And between our many jobs and creative endeavors, we use this podcast to ground us in a space where there are so many ways to lose yourself. So join us. We have real conversations with artists we admire on the Art Grind.
I like his energy. Calm.
Yeah, he's like a rock. So, welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. My name's Sophia.
I'm Marshall.
This is a podcast by artists for artists where we talk about
art.
Art.
An artist.
Describing the taste of water. I really think that's got to stick. I'm going to coin it.
Describing the taste of water?
Mm-hmm.
Trademarked?
Trademarked.
Sophia trademark?
Oh, yeah. Okay, listen. Nicholas Holober is on the show tonight.
Yes.
And he mentioned some really incredible artists, and they were just really contextualized his work. Here's a list of those artists. Matthew Monahan, Rothko, obviously. Marisol, M-A-R-I-S-O-L.
Uh-huh.
David Altmaier. Thomas Hausage.
A lot of artists I did not know.
Huma Baba.
Who I did know that.
Two separate words. Huma Baba. B-H-A, B-H-A.
I did see that one on the roof of the Met.
And seeing these images, like, I feel like we could have taken this podcast interview in a completely different direction.
So you're setting this up to people about to listen to it, what it could be.
This is what it could have been. It could have been great.
This could have been good.
Hey, you're right. Let's start over. So tonight we had Nicholas Holober on the show. What did we talk about, Marshall?
Wait, shouldn't we do the thing where we're like, hello, you're listening to the Art Grind Podcast.
We did that.
I'm your host, Marshall Jones. No, I'm doing it kind of like a movie thing.
Okay.
Your host, Marshall Jones.
Go. 1, 2, 3.
Hello, you're listening to the Art Grind Podcast. I'm your host, Marshall Jones.
I'm Sophia Kayafis.
Today, we interviewed the, what would you say, very calm, very talented, very thoughtful Nicholas Holober.
Absolutely. Physical.
Yeah, physical, uh-huh.
Metaphysical. Just kidding.
Uh-huh.
He's got sculptures on the brain. He's thinking in 3D while he's thinking in 2D. He's thinking in 2D when he's thinking in 3D.
That's right.
Experimental, accidental, fantastical.
No, I wanted you to make another experimental, accidental, inconsequential? No. It's maybe. Very hard to do. Experimental, accidental.
Okay, what was the word he was saying? He was saying that he doesn't like the artifice. Artificial.
He doesn't like to lie.
He doesn't like to lie.
Which I kind of think that's half the fun of art. It could be a bit of a lie. I think he's getting a little more in touch with that lately, though.
Honesty.
The artifist. No, I think he used to be more honest, right?
I think he used to be a Puritan about honesty.
He used to be a Puritan, yeah.
And he realized that was too draining.
I felt like this one asked a lot more questions than it answered. Right?
Yeah.
It was
engaging.
Because
we never answered what quality was, really. Never pinned that down.
Nope.
He talked about, yeah.
We didn't quite get to the meaning of life on this one.
No, but that's the best part. It's the introduction.
Yep, we talked about, for sure, quality came up a lot. Artifice came up a lot.
Experiment.
What makes a good painting? What makes an impactful artwork? What that means. It was a really great one.
We even talked about global warming.
We did.
Whoa.
Got a little sad there.
It's a little sad. Are we going to leave that in?
I think we should.
Okay.
It doesn't look good.
You guys need to hear this.
All right, everybody, enjoy our interview with Nicholas Holober.
Have a good one. And check out those artists.
Oh, yeah.
So I've written up all these questions I wanted to ask you.
Cool. I had to think really long and hard about an interesting childhood story. And I had to ask my mom, and we didn't really come up with anything, but we figured out why I am like I am,
I guess. Oh, that sounds good.
So you don't have one, huh?
I mean, I was talking with my mom about this, but I grew up, I have two brothers, so okay. There's three of us. And basically...
No girls?
No girls in the family, and I have two cousins who I grew up with, so they're basically like two other brothers, but there was like the five of us growing up. And I feel like you can relate to this because you come from a big family, but we were just constantly beating the shit out of each other. Like, my childhood revolved around violence between me and my brothers.
Like Lord of the Flies.
And sports and like competitiveness. That was like my whole childhood, basically.
Huh. Wow.
So I figured out that's kind of like a unique situation, maybe.
Yeah.
Where did you grow up? Did you grow up in the city?
No, we grew up just outside the city. So we grew up in the suburbs. And we grew up in like a really nice town. It was kind of a bubble.
What's the town? I might know.
Everybody knows it now because the Clintons moved there. It's called Chappaqua.
Okay, yeah.
And it was definitely like upper middle class. There wasn't much like diversity at all, and it was definitely like a bubble.
Okay.
But yeah, so I guess growing up, I was playing sports all throughout my childhood. That's like what I initially went to college for, was to play soccer.
Oh.
Yeah, and I had been making art like my whole childhood growing up, but
was that like a scholarship thing in college?
Yeah, I was a walk-on recruit, which means that they didn't want to pay me any money to play, but they recruited me as a walk-on. So
okay,
I went to the University of Vermont to play soccer.
Soccer.
And then yeah, Sophia and I played soccer together.
I didn't know you played soccer. You played soccer too?
I played soccer. I wasn't that great, but.
You were great. We won the league.
We won that league.
What league is this?
There's this amazing soccer league in the city of New York that people actually practice year round.
Yeah, like, people get really into it.
And they have like actual uniforms, and they all know each other. They meet weekly to practice. And we started a team with the academy.
The academy team.
We fucking won the championship.
Are you serious?
We won. We beat the whole city. And Nick was
my money would not be on the academy soccer.
We were actually really good. There were some really good players from the academy.
It was the best. They were so supportive.
At the end of every season, they gave us all like gift certificates to Paragon Sports. Yeah. It was amazing.
It was amazing.
Is this like
they're awesome.
That Zog Sports I see every now
and
again?
There's leagues all over the city. I think this was just like a Chelsea league or something that we were playing.
It was kind of small, yeah. But it was enough to like, we played some pretty competitive teams, and the thing is, we had all the people on the team had, see, I have a theory about why we won.
What?
I have a theory. I think as an artist, you have to have some sensitivity to material.
Yeah.
Okay, I think it had something to do with the touch.
Wax on, wax off.
Of this fucking ball. Because we all had incredible ball handling skills. And we could measure how far we have to kick it and where it needs to be. I think that's an artist thing. Because there's no other reason. Like, we don't even practice. We didn't even really practice. We never really played together. It was amazing.
Could be. You know, they say, I think doing things like that is about the only way to raise your IQ. Like the math that you do to kick a ball to someone moving downfield is like such an intense algorithm. Like if a computer came up with that math, it would just be pages and pages.
Yeah.
And when a human can just instinctually do that, like those type of repetitions will raise your intelligence.
That's cool.
So maybe doing art like that.
I feel like you've scored from the goalie.
fly. Is that, I don't know if that's a made up memory.
I think I might have made a field appearance. They're very rare.
You jumped right up there and scored once. he was supposed to be in the goal box.
Wait, you were the goalie?
He's the goalie. Yeah, he's incredible hand eye, and he can fucking just catch anything. Okay. He's like not, because when you're a goalie, you have to be pretty brave. Like what you're saying with your brothers, you're getting all these fights.
Yeah.
You have to be willing to fucking take a hit in the face, a foot to the face.
Fearless, I guess.
Because he would run up while someone's about to plow him and just fucking grab the ball.
Well, isn't soccer getting like a bad, like sort of in that conversation now about head injuries for football players?
Yeah, I've heard that. But like hitting a ball or something is meant to have the same effect over time as like playing football or something like that. But I don't know. I actually got a concussion from soccer, a pretty bad concussion.
You did?
Oh, shit.
Yeah, it was in high school. It was like a sectional game and I went up for a ball and somebody took my legs out and I like landed on my head and got knocked out. And I just remember like being on the sideline and like not being able to see straight and being like, let me go back in. And that whole fucking thing. Thank God I didn't go back in. But, yeah, but I mean, that's what I spent like the first 20 years of my life doing, was playing soccer, basically.
Sports, fighting your brothers, really masculine, rough and tumble.
Girl. Yeah,
but you played soccer with them too?
Yeah, so my older brother, the reason I'm a goalie is because my older brother was a midfielder and he's 3.5 years older than me and he needed somebody to shoot against.
Oh my God.
So when I was little, he just like threw me in goal and that's how I became a goalie. That's like the only reason I'm a goalie. Probably the only reason I play soccer.
It sounds like he got the better end of that deal.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he just, go in goal. Yeah. Save these balls. but yeah, after. I played soccer through my sophomore year, and then I had this like weird knee injury, and then I stopped playing. And that was kind of when I transitioned into like focusing more on art. But I had been making art, throughout my childhood and in high school and stuff like that.
What kind of art were you doing as a kid?
Just mostly drawing and painting. I think I started oil painting when I was in high school, and I had this really amazing art teacher in high school, Mrs. Crosby, who was like unbelievable, but I can't remember. I think I dropped out of the AP art class because it was like too structured and too demanding for my interests, I guess, at the time. Hmm. But she would let me just like cut class and go hide in the back of the room and like paint and do stuff like that. So I think that was really important in like being able to kind of navigate high school. I didn't love high school. I mean, I had a really close group of friends, but I was like kind of an art kid in a jock's body, and it was like these conflicting kind of things going on all the time. Right. I mean, my high school was great, but it wasn't in my kind of circle, wasn't like the coolest thing to like be the art kid. So I kind of like wasn't the art kid in high school.
And you were playing sports throughout high
school.
And
I was playing sports. I mean, I played soccer, lacrosse. I played football 1 year in high school too. So, but I was playing soccer year round and my life was kind of dominated by sports.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. You're making all these points about how physical your upbringing was in a certain way. I feel like there's a real physicality to your work.
Well, that's the connection that when I was speaking to my mom about my childhood and beating the shit out of my brothers, and, I realized that our whole household was physical, like whatever we were doing, just because of us being who we were. But there was always this kind of creative outlet for me. My mom's an artist. She's a ceramic artist. Mm. And so there was always this kind of outlet for me to creatively express myself, whether it was like through ceramics classes when I was little or just like drawing in my room or something like that. Mm-hmm. My older brother's not really, didn't get the creative gene, but my younger brother was definitely like a maker growing up, but he was always making like things out of clay and stuff like that. So there was always that creative outlet in the household, which I think was really important to kind of balance that like masculine physicality of who we were. But yeah, I think I definitely see a connection now, or see a reason why I like to work the way I do, working like physically with my entire body and sweating and struggling and stuff like that. I can see it kind of like stems from that experience.
Would you call yourself a sculptor, a painter, a draftsman, or just an artist?
I guess I'm an artist, maybe. See, I was never like trained in sculpture. Mm. I'm terrible at mold making.
No, you're not.
I am. I can't make a mold to save my life. It's really bad. I didn't take an art class at school, so, and I don't know. I think like a painter, but I'm more drawn to sculpture just because of, like, I guess the physicality of the work, but also I think I just like objects more than I like paintings.
Mm-hmm. I remember when you came to my apartment once, you were talking to me about the relationship between painting and sculpture.
Yeah.
And that painting was like a lie, and sculpture was like, it was what it was.
Yeah.
It wasn't an illusion of form, it just was the form.
Yeah, I mean, I think sculpture can still be an illusion, and I think a lot of what I was saying was kind of like a carryover of my feelings about painting from when I was in school. And I know you've had Vince on the show, right? I've listened to him.
Mm-hmm.
So his class, like, totally fucked me up because it was the first time I thought about painting as, like, an artifice in front of you. And for some reason, I don't know, I just, like, couldn't get over this painting as an artifice idea. And it just threw my whole studio practice in this, you know, into this, like, weird questioning everything.
Because you were uncomfortable with it being an artifice?
And that affected you by your mid-year crit, didn't it?
Yeah, I think I was working on my thesis during my second year, and I was writing my thesis on 9/11.
Conspiracy.
It wasn't so much about the conspiracy, but I did get into a deep conspiracy hole, which...
Like it was an inside job type conspiracy.
I read that, like, and I was like, wow.
Crazy. I was watching... First of all, I moved into an apartment like 2 blocks away from the World Trade Center. And then I started finding all these, like, YouTube videos, this just crazy and disgusting videos.
Were you in the city when it happened?
No, I was in high school. I remember I was in homeroom in high school. I was a junior. And somebody was like, somebody flew into the World Trade Center. And I remember a friend next to me started laughing, thinking it was like a joke. And then we went into the library and saw the second plane hit. And everybody freaked out. Everybody just went home. My dad was in the air at the time flying to LA, and we weren't sure, like, what plane it was and, like, where he was. And
oh, my God.
It was just insane. And there were several people from my high school who had family members and friends die in the attacks. But the paper I was writing at the time just, like, took me to a really dark place. And the paper itself wasn't so much – I had, like, a section about conspiracy theories and what that meant, but – the paper wasn't in itself about the conspiracy theories, but I think that combining with Vince's
artifice
statement just made, like, kind of glaze me over and was like, everything is a lie, you know? And, just maybe, I guess, question a lot what I was doing in the studio and, like, why I was doing it.
So it's like a real sort of, like, crisis in a way.
Yeah. I mean, it was probably like a little overdramatic because I was in school, like, all day, every day. It was the only thing I was focusing on. So it was, like, the biggest problem in my life at the time. But, yeah, it definitely, like, caused a crisis in my studio practice. And that mid-year crit that I had, all of the work was in one way or another, like, about September 11th or basically taking that narrative and that theme and, like, working it into what I was making at the time. And the crit, I just got, like, destroyed. It was just, like, it wasn't a bloodbath, but it was just, like, terrible critique. And then I don't know, like, how I snapped out of it, but I just kind of relaxed a little bit and kind of embraced the whole artifice thing and focused more on, like, materiality and experimentation and just kind of let it go, I guess.
And where does that...
Well,
sorry, Marshall.
Okay, you could go ahead.
I just want to say, where does that take you now? If you had to write another thesis, I mean, what are you obsessed with right now? Is it still just experimentation and materiality, or is there a concept or a social something?
I think the challenge... My challenge is kind of like merging my interest in materials with content. And, you know, I really like to experiment with material and like push material. But I think I don't want to create work that's just about the material. I want it to have like some kind of narrative and have some kind of context rather than it just being like
formalist.
Formalist, or just a mix of like shit that you wouldn't think would be in a painting or something like that. Mm. And that's like the challenge I think I've always been faced with is I'm interested in these materials that may not be artistic materials, but how do I use them in an artistic way? Mm. And like give them new meaning in a sense.
Okay. Or,
you know, inform them with content and a narrative. So maybe you forget what it is, what material it is like you're looking at.
Okay. So just so our listeners know, if you go on NicholasHollibird.com, Nicholas is spelled with just one C.
No H in my name.
No H. It took me forever to figure that out.
Same.
You can go to his images. He's got sculptures, paintings, and some drawings. Is that correct? And,
yeah.
And you, the materials you've listed for, let's say, Moon Man is reclaimed wood, plaster, hardwood, hardware, paint. And there's many other things in there, too. Maybe list a few more. I don't know.
I think in that body of work, I was using a lot of like reclaimed or recycled wood. So wood that I just either find on the street, like around the studio, or wood that's made from shipping pallets that are just lying around the street. I think there's plaster in that, acrylic medium, paint. Actually, I think most of the work from that group is made of the wood that was my fellow thesis show, my fellowship show. I recycled most of the wood. I recycled most of the sculptures from that show. So they're all really marked up and they have like these little drawings on them. They're all fragmented. But yeah, that was like a kind of weird body of work that I made. I don't know if going forward, like my sculptures are going to be looking like that necessarily. But
what about them were you looking to change?
I think that body of work... that Sophia's looking at.
You can see it, right?
I can kind of see it. Yeah. Oh, that's from my, yeah, that's from the fellowship show. I really like some of those pieces and some of them I really don't like, but those were kind of my first like forays into sculpture, but I think they have, when I look at them now, they just seem like a little immature to me for some reason. But that might not be a bad thing. But I think the work after that, I was just so focused on like making sculpture. I wasn't really thinking about material so much. I was just kind of making work with whatever I had in the studio.
Mm-hmm. I think looking back on any work is a little brutal to the person making it because it'll all feel a little... underdeveloped, you know?
Yeah. But no, I do enjoy, really enjoy some of the pieces from that kind of period, which isn't even too long ago. But, you know, when you think about like your development, you can't really say if I didn't do that, I'd be making the work I'm making now. So I can't totally like knock it and hate it.
Yeah. John was saying, John Wellington in an interesting way, like a work of art is just a measure of time in your life when it all kind of comes down to it. That's just, you know, a year of your life and that's what it is.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, Birds on Broadway.
The Birds.
You've done a whole, I didn't realize how much public art, you have a whole page of public art. One I knew of was Head of Goliath. Walked by it all the time.
Cool.
I love that piece. And now I get to walk by all these incredible birds. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
And let's talk about dates first. So plug it first, Nicholas, like when the dates are that people can see this.
Yeah, so Birds on Broadway was installed on May 17th of this year, and then it's up through January 2020. And... there are 10 sculptures installed along Broadway. The exhibition starts at 64th Street, right outside of Lincoln Center, and then goes up to 157th Street.
So like 100 blocks worth.
Yeah, just about 100 blocks.
It's amazing.
It's probably nice. You could walk that, right? Like if you're feeling up to it.
It's a little over 5 miles. I suggest doing it like in the fall when it's not 100 degrees out.
Yeah, you don't have to. Like, not over the last weekend.
Not over last weekend. Oh my God.
You said you were painting the wood before you would put the bolts in.
Yeah, so the process for building these birds, which was the same process for like Head of Goliath that you saw, but all of the wood gets painted before it's built, and then I break it down and chop it up, and then I basically build with the pieces. The birds are a little bit more stylized than Head of Goliath was, but basically I'm chopping up all this wood. It's on the studio floor, and then I'm looking down at the pieces and fitting them onto the sculpture.
With like preliminary sketches and stuff?
No, I don't really work from preliminary sketches. I designed little 3D models of the birds on the computer.
Okay.
So that gave me like a good idea of how I was going to build them. But when I was actually working, I wasn't working from like a blueprint or a sketch.
Wow.
I was kind of just like building and going. But that's the beauty of working with wood, is you can make it fast and you can edit it really fast. So, you know,
what do you mean edit it fast?
You can make changes. You know, if I build something and it's not right, I can take it apart really quickly, or I can chop it off with a saw in a few minutes. It's not like working with metal where it's a little more exact. Mm-hmm. You have to be a little more exact.
Mm. But what about, I mean, you were making specific species of birds.
Yeah.
So did you have to look, like study what makes that bird that bird?
No, I looked at photos and stuff as I was working to make sure like the positioning was right. But I don't know. I think maybe building them in the computer helped me a lot. Because if you saw the computer renderings, they're pretty close to the actual sculptures. But I don't know. I think if I had worked from specific sketches and like a blueprint or something, I would just die of boredom. I wouldn't be able to do it.
They might have lost something in the end too, you know. They probably have a little bounciness to them right now.
Yeah, and so much about the art making process for me is exploration and just kind of like discovering as I go and making changes as I need it. You know, there's like a certain struggle in that. I mean, I could spend like a whole week doing something and it could be totally wrong. Once I walk around the sculpture, I'm like, fuck, this is like a whole week's worth of work. I have to take it apart. Uh-huh. And there were a lot of those moments. But I think failure in my process is a huge part, like plays a huge part in the overall outcome of a piece.
I think it's important in art in general. I mean, you can almost tell when something's done too cleanly or...
Yeah, you know it when you look at it. You're like, this is too slick, or this is too manufactured or something.
Yeah.
My buddy said that if an artist is satisfied, they're probably bored. I don't know how true that is, but it sounds about right.
Well,
you're getting what you wanted all the time.
Yeah, I think there's like a theory I have about a lot of people's work, that it feels like it's strongest at the beginning or middle before it just gets too rote, before they really know what they're doing, you know?
Yeah.
And then once that machinery's really greased, I just get real bored by it. And then it's like, they need to do something else. Which is pretty brutal to what we do. It's like, once you get good at it, you gotta change it up.
Get rid of it. I was gonna ask you, what's the difference between an artist, what did I say, an architect, an engineer, and a manual laborer, like a contractor, for you?
Wow.
I feel like that you have a broad...
I think all those professions besides an artist has like a real concrete purpose as to their occupation. Mm-hmm. You know, an artist's job is kind of up to them to create in a way. I mean, an architect, the way I see an architect is they'll you know, design something in a very schematic way, and they'll make plans for it. They're very like organized in that way, and I guess the contractor carries out those plans and will be the fabricator, and the general laborer is going to be the person doing all the work. You know, I think an artist basically can embody or like borrow from any one of those professions, but like I was listening to Wade's podcast the other day, nobody's asking you to be an artist. Like there's not, you don't have a purpose like those occupations have a purpose. So I think there's maybe a little like existential difference between like an artist and those kind of professions.
When you're doing these commissions, you kind of take a, you have kind of have a foot in the river, a foot in the bank kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean,
how does that feel?
The Bird Project, was the first project where I really felt like, okay, this isn't necessarily the type of work or thematically the type of work that I would make in my studio. But I was really lucky because I got to make it however I wanted to make it. There were no creative restrictions on what I was making.
That's amazing. That's rare.
Which is, yeah, which is, you know, if you do a commission, if you're lucky, you know, you can kind of creatively dictate what's going on. But, you know, I've had other commissions before too where it's like I'm just the laborer carrying out whatever they want. And that's cool too. But this project was the first time where I was, you know, working with all these other organizations, but I had a very specific, I guess, theme of the work. And, you know, I had to think about other things too, like public safety and approachability and all that stuff.
Oh, wow.
Public safety for people viewing them.
You know, like it could fall on them or if
a, yeah.
Rusty nail.
Get stuck.
Rusty nails or... Yeah, if somebody's climbing on them, like, is it going to be able to hold somebody?
Oh,
so,
my God.
Does that come on you if something does happen?
No, luckily, one of the partners, New York City Audubon, provided the insurance, the liability insurance for the exhibition. So, I mean, but the sculptures are solid. They're like 2,000 pounds, over 2,000 pounds.
Each?
And, yeah. The smaller ones weigh like 1500 pounds, but the bigger ones weigh probably like 2250 or something.
And was this all found wood that you,
it was all reclaimed wood. So
reclaimed.
The sculptures were built in kind of two phases. The first phase, was basically just building out the skeletons. Mm-hmm. And for that phase, which took like the first half of the year, I partnered with Big Reuse. They're an organization out in Brooklyn, and they do a lot of community work. They're a nonprofit, but they also take in salvageable materials and then resell them. And so they donated all the lumber that I needed for the first phase. So all of that wood came from like apartments and projects in the city that could be reused, and they gave it to that company, and then that company gave it to me. And then the second half of the build was putting on all the feathers, which are like these little 6 to 8 inch pieces of wood. And all of that wood came in. I was working in a warehouse in Long Island City, and I was sharing the space with a construction company. And the construction company would get all of their materials and equipment delivered on wooden pallets. Just like the shipping pallets, not, they had crates too, but most of it was just the shipping pallets that like, you know, like industrial materials come on.
Okay.
The little jack kind of loads them up.
Yeah. The jack, the floor jack or the forklift will pick them up. But they had like hundreds of these pallets in the warehouse. And, I worked out a deal where they would just give them to me. So I remember I was working in, and I'm like, not talking to anybody. I like just slip in through the front gate. All these guys are like working around me. They're like grinding shit. You know, they're like unwrapping materials. They're building across the street. So this warehouse was kind of just a storage facility for them, but they'd eat lunch there and whatever. And I'd like sneak my dog in past the guard and like tie him up in the back so nobody would see him. And this one day, this guy came over to me and he was like, I was just in a meeting with the foreman. He's like, he told me not to throw away the palettes. He said, give them to the bird guy. And I'm like, who the fuck is the bird guy? And I'm just like standing there with like a drill in my hand. I'm like, yeah, I'm the bird guy. Like, it's me. And so I don't even think a lot of guys knew I was in there in the back, but soon, like as I was there longer, guys would kept coming up and they'd be talking to me, and they were an awesome group of guys, but they were happy to give me the palettes because they would get in trouble for just tossing them. They were supposed to reuse them themselves, but they didn't really have any use for them.
So it's easier to offload them.
It's easier just to like, they're like, save them for the bird guy.
Who the fuck is the bird guy?
It was like so good. Such like a thick New York accent too. It was amazing.
I love it.
But yeah, they were really cool. And, they would like help me out and then come ask me like, what are you doing here? Where are these birds going? And like, can you build me a table? I'm like, no. But
how long were you working on this project? Over a year, right?
Yeah, so the fabrication took a little over a year. I mean, the whole process from like creating the proposal to the end of the project was like 3.5 years.
Oh my God.
Wow.
And it was just a totally insane everything. I mean, just the amount of work that goes into creating the proposal and like going through that whole process is really wild.
I mean, this project lasted so long. I mean, it took over a huge part of your life. In some ways, it's shaped a piece of your identity you'll never get back.
Yeah. The Birdman.
Birdman. Who the fuck?
How has that shaped? Do you feel, maybe it's too soon to ask this, but how do you feel like it's affected you as an artist in some way? Do you feel like it's shaped what the way you approach your work now? When you come back to the studio, what's going on? Is it, do you think about the birds? I mean, in some way, are they coming into your studio?
I think about the birds a lot, but I think it's, yeah, I mean, it has definitely changed the way I think about things and kind of what I want to do moving forward as an artist. I think it's definitely made me think more about material and my intention in terms of my own studio practice. And it's also, I guess, made me think more about public art, you know, as an opportunity or a new venue to kind of try to go into. You know, the year was kind of like a bittersweet year because it was amazing because I was working on this project and it's the only thing I needed to do that year in terms of like working, which was amazing.
Felt like going to a job, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was the first time in my life where like working on my art was like a full-time thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all I've ever wanted, you know, since I got out of school. And it was incredible just to be able to do that for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it made me think also that, you know, it made me realize the difference between like public art and private studio practice. And, you know, public art might not necessarily be the same things I'm making in my studio, but it could be a way for me to like support myself and
almost like a commissioned portrait painter or something.
Yeah. You know, but it was extremely difficult. There were a few like really big road blocks this year in terms of the project that like were really hard to get through. But, you know, I think in the end it was just like doing the best with what I had. And I'm proud of the way they came out.
They're really beautiful.
Thanks. But yeah, I mean, I think like anything, I would do things differently, you know, if I could. I wouldn't do it all over again. I don't know about that, but, you know, it made me, it was a good, like, learning experience for sure.
I want to go a little bit more into the studio. Like you were saying, wood is easy to edit. You had computer sketches, but you didn't really rely, like, a little less of an architect on that. You were sort of, did you have in your head what they were going to be and you were just chasing that, or was it sort of being, you know, kind of constructed as you went, even your image of them?
Yeah. And this is similar to, my normal studio practice is that I don't work from sketches. I mean, I might have an idea in my mind of what I'm making, but I really let the process of making determine what the final thing I'm making is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the birds, the ducks, there's six ducks, I think, their framework is pretty much the same. Like they all have like a body and the head and the neck. Their poses aren't that different. There are a couple that are like looking up or something, but, you know, I tried to like capture their essence really. And the birds that I chose, some of them have really unique characteristics. Like the hooded merganser has this enormous like hood. It doesn't even look like a real animal if you saw it in real life, but it's got like a mohawk almost of feathers. And so I just focused on bringing out those characteristics that made it more identifiable as that bird. And I didn't focus so much on like anatomical accuracy. I like feel okay eyeballing all the proportions and the dimensions and stuff like that.
It's so cool. It's a pretty risky way to work, but I think it really allows a lot of kind of your signature and vision on top
quality.
Of that. Yeah, quality. Sophia's into that.
I've been talking about quality all day long. I was teaching today. Did you read the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance?
No, I've heard about it.
It's really fucking good. Can I read you some quotes about it? I want to see your. I want to know what you think about it.
Sure.
Because I think it applies to you. You have quality in your work.
Thank you.
I love it. All right, let's see here. Here's a couple quotes from this book. This character, Phaedrus, has lost his memories going on a motorcycle drive across America trying to figure out who he was. And he's asking things about philosophy, about what life means.
He's unraveling. He's losing his identity and taking on the name Phaedrus.
Thank you. Okay. At the moment of pure quality, perception... Or not even perception. At the moment of pure quality, with a capital Q, there are no subject or object. There's only a sense of quality that produces a later awareness of subjects and objects. At the moment of pure quality, subject and object are the same.
Deep.
Okay, this one. If the creator, owner, or user have no sense of identity, there is no quality. Okay? Care and quality are internal and external aspects of the same thing. A person who sees quality and feels it as he works is a person who cares. A person who cares about what he sees and does is a person who's bound to have some characteristic of quality.
I agree with that one. I didn't agree with the last one.
Okay, and then there's two more. When quality enters the picture as the third metaphysical entity, the preselection of facts is no longer arbitrary, so it seems on purpose. Maybe we shouldn't read that. Craftsman is never following a single line of instruction. He's making decisions as he goes along. For that reason, he'll be absorbed and attentive to what he's doing, even though he doesn't deliberately contrive this. His motions and the machine are in a kind of harmony. He isn't following any set of written instructions because the nature of the material at hand determines his thoughts and motions, which simultaneously change the nature of the material at hand.
Park on that. That's what you were talking about, basically.
Cool. I mean, so Sophia, do you think quality is something that's not like found so much in art these days?
I think wow, that's a good question. All I can say is it's something that I'm seeking. Yeah. And that when I see it, I know it. And he's saying, Marshall's saying that it's not something you can put your finger on. It's not something you can teach. It's almost like, in that way, composition. How do you teach composition without being prescriptive?
Mm-hmm.
But you know when you see it. Like when you go to the Louvre and you see the Raft of the Medusa in person. You know why it's there. You know why there's a Louvre after you see that painting. You know what I mean? Like, that's quality.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the rubric they apply to, like, pornography. You can't describe, but you know it when you see it. You know, like...
Okay, well, then I don't know.
But I think that you and I would differ walking around the Louvre on what quality is.
Absolutely.
So I think it is undefinable. What do you think?
Yeah, I wonder how linked like quality and craftsmanship are. I mean, when I think about quality, I think about integrity of whatever's made or whatever's done. I think it can also be something that you just sense and feel. It doesn't have to be something that's extremely worked or like an expert or somebody made it. I think it can come from a feeling or just something that's done with like a real sense of love, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I do think about like quality a lot as it relates to, I guess, craftsmanship. And, you know, I mean, now you can just get somebody else to paint your paintings. So like, why don't you just do that?
Does it miss quality when when you hire an assistant to do it? I mean, like, do Rubens paintings take a hit in quality because there were so many people painting on this?
Absolutely. I've seen one specific painting of Rubens. You could tell each one of those people had a different idea of what quality was and what that painting should look like. Mm-hmm. It looks like totally upside down. You're like, what the fuck is going on here? You can tell like Rubens definitely wanted to paint that horse's ass and the wolf's face getting speared to the heart. Like, and he made everyone else do some other shit to it. And it suffers because of that. Ultimately, it does suffer. It looks disjointed.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But that's not, that's like... I mean, does quality then just mean unity in some way, like a unified statement?
I don't know. I feel moved by work that has the image and the way that the image is made kind of embedded into one another. Like the way Desiderio talks about technical narrative.
Yeah.
Like the three narratives, I guess there's technical narrative, dramatic narrative, and then narrativity.
When it's like out in the world or whatever.
Yeah, like how does that painting of that horse's butt relate to all the other horse butts that have ever been painted? And other people's interactions with actual horse butts in the world. Like, I don't know. Like, and then the theatrical narrative, what's actually happening? Someone's riding the horse. And then how is that painted? I think that's the glue for me. You can really tell the way they're describing the horse, but it's telling you about who they are.
And there are so many horse butt paintings, actually. There's so many, if you really think about it.
But like that can only happen really when there's one artist in front of one canvas or making one sculpture. Mm. Like, I think that originality gets lost when, right, there's somebody painting somebody else's idea of originality.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm drawn to the same type of artwork, I think, for that reason. Otherwise, I would have just gotten assistants to make the birds.
Do you feel...
No, I did have one assistant.
Do you feel it in your work when you achieve quality? Like, is that a stopping point for you, or do you like, or do you even think about it?
I don't think about, I don't know if like originality is the word I'm thinking about.
It's a side effect.
I'm looking at what I'm making or when I know when to stop what I'm doing. But I think I try to push myself either mostly like through material in doing things that haven't normally done in the past. And I think it's like a good way to kind of, you know, keep things fresh in the studio. But it also, I mean, 90% of the things that I do in the studio never make it out of the studio, because I'm always kind of like experimenting with things or trying new materials. you know, I think it's kind of caused me to create these different bodies of work based on the material I'm using. Like really early on, I was using wax, beeswax, and then I moved into tar for a little while. I'm still using tar, but then I was using like acrylic medium and just finding all these different materials to work with. And the work that comes out of that is kind of a reaction to the material. But again, like I say, I'm kind of struggling and challenging myself to form some kind of narrative with these material that's more than just an abstract, formal, whatever. But I think I try to do things in the studio so that whatever I'm doing feels original to me, like I haven't done this before.
Mm-hmm. So original to you yourself, not so much original to what's out in the greater art world.
Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody's probably worked with like some form of tar before, but I haven't worked with this with it in this way. Mm-hmm. So it's original to me until it's not anymore, and then maybe I'll like move on from that body of work.
So you like to have something that foreign. You have to, yeah, foreign to react to, something that forces invention in the middle of the process.
Yeah, for sure.
Interesting. Do you have a favorite bird that you learned about from doing this?
God, I like know too much about birds now. I really do like the hooded merganser. I think they're just a spectacular looking bird. They're just so unique looking and weird. I really like the double crested cormorant.
Okay.
Because I feel like they have a lot of attitude, but they're also just kind of lazy. They just sit by on the rocks like in sunbathe. And then when they're hungry, they'll like dive into the water and catch some fish and then go back up on the rocks.
Which one is that?
It's the black one.
Black and red?
Yeah.
Are all these endangered birds, correct?
Yeah, so the whole backbone of the exhibition is to raise awareness for these birds and for a larger number of birds that are endangered due to threats caused by climate change. So there's a group of, I think, 314 North American species that over the next like 50 to 80 years are expected to lose up to like 95% of their habitat because of global warming and climate change. So these birds that are on Broadway in particular are native to New York City, meaning they pass through the city or live here.
Like migration patterns.
Migration patterns and stuff like that. You can actually find all 10 of these birds in and around the city, which is amazing in itself because...
Even the owl, huh?
Yeah, the owl. In Queens at Floyd Bennett Field, I think there's been a few sightings of them. And there was a snowy owl on Governor's Island a few years ago.
Wow. One of my friends who's a painter, he goes to the Art Students League. He works for Audubon Society and just says, like, you can, because of that migration pattern sort of over Central Park and stuff, you can see more birds there than almost, you know, it's like amazing.
Yeah, it's crazy. What's his name?
Todd Winston.
Oh, cool.
How do you feel about global warming?
Love it.
Yeah, after this weekend? Oh, my God.
Swimming in November.
Yeah. I think I have maybe a more pessimistic view now that I've done this project and, you know, the way our government has kind of behaved, I guess, in the last few years. And I don't know, I don't think that the future is, like, going to be that fun for the next few generations, but you know, I also think that there is a chance for us to like make things right.
I agree with that,
but I don't know. I mean, I really question whether anything's going to change because there's just so much back and forth and you know, just so much bullshit that happens in terms of like a policy level. But no, I do have faith that like we can change this if we want to, and that, you know, we won't end in like an apocalyptic fireball. But it's hard to kind of see that not happening also.
I was talking about this to my girlfriend and my roommate the other day about recycling and about the power of the consumer, that the dollar is worth more than the vote. You can vote every day. Mm-hmm. Every time you buy something, you are supporting so many no-no situations.
Yeah, but I would disagree with you there. I think that it's our administration's responsibility to ensure whatever it is we're buying as consumers, you know, doesn't...
Ideally.
I know, but, like, one person can only recycle so much. If that recycling ends up in a landfill, what the hell is the point, you know?
And if I mean, they say it's hard to get the message out to people because it almost is that, I mean, when you get real data, it makes you really cynical. Like, I could lower my carbon footprint as low as it could go, and it's not going to matter at all.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, to your point, it's more of a policy level because I recycle everything and I don't feel like I'm making any difference at all. And it's not, you know,
you know, it's like everybody, I've seen like all those metal straws, like, you know, blowing up on Instagram or whatever. It's like, how much energy is like used to make that metal straw? And then all of the packaging, the plastic or the paper that it's shipped in or whatever. It's like, why, you know, it's like people are giving people shit for using plastic straws. Why don't you just make paper straws and put them in the coffee shop and not give out plastic straws? You know, it's just like, I don't know. Some of these issues, I think, it's your responsibility as a consumer to do things in the best like way you can environmentally and sustainably. But I think it's also the responsibility when we live in a society where like everything's controlled, you know, by a higher power or a government, they need they need to implement the best practices for us to choose from. Because if I'm going to buy a new car, you know, and I can buy an electric car that costs 30 grand, or I can buy a diesel powered car that costs 15 grand, I'm going to buy the diesel powered car.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a no brainer.
Yeah.
I don't blame people for choosing the most affordable option. I blame, you know, the business for not making that option more available. But yes, like, you should recycle and you should use paper or metal straws. But I don't know. I think I'm maybe a little more cynical than I should be about stuff, but, you know, it's hard when you do the research, like, to not be cynical.
Economics are so rough too. Like, I mean, whatever, locally sourced, all that stuff, there's a price markup, and who can afford that stuff? You know, it's rough.
No, it's hard. And I was listening to the How I Built This podcast, and it had Alice Winters, the chef of Chez Panisse in San Francisco area. Anyway, she's a big advocate for, you know, organic foods and home cooking and stuff like that. And they were interviewing her and talking about like all the backlash she's gotten about, you know, promoting organic foods and that kind of thing. And she made a really good argument, and it was that, you know, organic foods might cost a little more, but you know, if you know how to cook, a whole chicken can feed a family of four for a week. And it's not really an economic thing that's the problem in our country. It's an education thing. Like, people don't know how to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't utilize the food the way they should.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't mind paying extra for like an organic chicken if I know how to cook it, it's going to last through the week. But, you know, she's really trying to promote education reform and health reform through food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
that's
the
best way. I mean, that's something that's purchased every day.
Yeah, but you know, I think education is a big part of it too. Yeah. I mean, when I was in high school, climate change, we weren't really learning about climate change. No. Mm-hmm. but you know.
Well, so many people just don't believe in it.
Well, it becomes a political issue, and then it's like not even worth talking about because it just doesn't go anywhere.
So what are you said 95% of the habitat for some of these birds is going to get eliminated.
Yeah, so for this group of birds, up to 95, the numbers are pretty outstanding, but their habitat is basically changing and shifting and shrinking and expanding in other areas of the country where they don't normally go. So for the snowy owl, for example, they've never really come this far south in the past, but because of global warming, you know, they can spend the winters down here more easily because it's colder in here in the winter. So that, you know, might not be a bad thing, but their summer range might change and they might be forced into areas where they haven't been in the past. Their food source might not be there. You know, they might have a harder time nesting. So it's really kind of up in the air as to if basically these birds will be able to adapt to the new habitat that they'll have.
And that bird this far south, meaning like New York City, which is,
yeah.
Wow.
You know, they're usually up like in Canada around the Arctic and stuff. Another one of the birds, I think the wood duck, they usually nest, you know, in lakes, like around lakes, around lake beds and stuff. But as the climate warms, they're getting pushed further north and they might not necessarily have the same habitat where they're used to. So, you know, if they don't adapt, then they'll die out. But, you know, if they might adapt, they might not. But yeah, it was the first, also this project was the first time that I thought about global warming and climate change not related to humans. Like I never thought about how it affected animals.
Yeah.
And I don't think many people think about that. I just think about, you know, New York City is going to be underwater in 100 years, but what is that going to mean for all the animal life? But yeah, I don't know.
Was it on your mind? We just had a brutally hot weekend here with like blackouts in the city and all that stuff. It's just
crazy how we can go from like 105 degrees or whatever it was 3 days ago, and today it was like 75 degrees.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit, this is nice. I'm actually cold.
Uh-huh.
It was just, it's on my mind a lot. So I went to college in Vermont, and when I was a freshman going up there, there used to be snow in August on the mountains. And then I still go up there really often. In August, it's like 100 degrees. There's no fucking snow anywhere. And just in, you know, I've been out of college for like 12 years. Just in 12 years, you can see the difference. So it is kind of scary when you think about that. And, you know, there's been like papers and theses on how, I think it's, they said Vermont, I forgot what paper it was, but they said Vermont was going to be like Cincinnati or something, the climate.
Oh, wow.
And, like, the climate's just going to totally shift, and basically people aren't going to be able to survive in the cities because the weather is going to be too drastic. And I believe it. I mean, you know, I think we're really close to the tipping point, but I don't know.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick break.
Sorry, that was...
Take it. Hey guys, make sure you donate to the podcast.
Yep. Oh, by the way, few people have come up to me and said it's very hard to donate, and they tried and they sort of got a little discouraged and stopped.
What?
Yes.
Tell Tom that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Sorry, guys.
Sorry, it's hard.
I'm sorry it's hard. You can just mail us a check.
Get out and go in your pocketbook and get out your check.
This is making it a little easier for you. That actually might be the way, huh?
Anyway, thanks for donating all your hard-earned checks. We'll talk to you later.
Guess what, listeners? This artist that you're listening to right now, he also has a little side business called Nico's Handmade Stretchers. They're beautifully crafted, built to last, and available for custom sizing at a competitive price. Use the code GRIND to receive 10% off the entire order plus free NYC delivery. I think you should take him up on this deal, especially at a time like this when we should be, you know, supporting individual artists rather than big corporate companies. So, yeah, Nicholas Holliber, excellent craftsman supplying New York's finest stretcher bars. Just log on to www.nicoshandmade.com. That's Nicos, N-I-C-O-S, handmade.com, and enter the code GRIND to receive 10% off your entire order, plus free NYC delivery. Thanks, Nicholas.
Hey, this is Tun, the producer. When I started this podcast, I didn't know where to begin. One of the best decisions I made, though, on my podcasting journey is to choose Buzzsprout as my podcasting host. It made my job so much easier. They had a clean interface and a really easy-to-use dashboard. They also make it super easy to be listed on all major podcast directories like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher. If you'd like to create your own podcast and join over 100,000 other podcasters who are already using Buzzsprout, just follow the link in the show notes and get a $20 Amazon gift card after you sign up for a paid plan. Do you like what you've been listening to so far? This podcast is supported by our listeners. So feel free to shower us with donations on our website at artgrindpodcast.com. We really appreciate our donors that's letting us do what we do best. And don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. All right, guys. Until next time. Peace.
You're saying it's hard for you to... Because you like material so much, you're kind of dealing with maybe trying to find narrative.
Or yeah.
When you do figuration, even in the sculptures, the stuff even from fellowship stuff, those are embedded with so much symbolism and meaning that they don't really need a narrative. I feel like I get the whole story.
Yeah, that's but cool.
That, as you're moving into the newer work, it's more fragmented, becomes more formalist in that way. And you're saying you're struggling with that. Can you talk about that more?
Yeah, I think I like jump around a lot in terms of the way I make things and how things end up come out, how things end up looking as they're finished. But I don't know. I think when I make something, I'm really emotionally tied to it and I really give it a lot of emotional energy. Mm. And I think at whatever, wherever I am in my life at that time, my work reflects that. So, you know, it can be very fragmented and like aggressive, but you know, there are times in other parts of my work where it's a lot more calm and I guess a little more clear on like an image or a process. But, I think that's another thing I struggle with is just like jumping around from place to place and from different mediums to different mediums. To me, it doesn't look like it's a whole cohesive body of work. You know, my work is like split up into these segments that are really based on the material. Mm-hmm. It could span a couple of years, but you know, it's like based on the material decisions I was making at the time. I think moving forward now and after doing this project, what I really want to pay attention to is like making a cohesive body of work, you know, across different
mediums.
So like, how do I make a sculpture that looks like this painting? And how do I make a painting that looks like this sculpture?
Mm. You know, it's interesting because you did a painting of a pig.
Yeah.
Mm. And it looked, I was struck by thinking, boy, this painting almost looks like his sculpture out of wood. Like if you were going to do the pig out of wood, it would look a lot like that painting.
Yeah. So I'm interested in those kind of two things. And, you know, it's going to take like some experimenting and stuff like that. But I have always been, since I started making sculptures, like looking at sculpture from a painter's point of view and maybe looking at painting from a sculptor's point of view. But yeah,
could you explain, like, for our listeners, just explain that a little, like, what that would mean to you, painting from a sculptor's point of view and vice versa.
So like painting from a sculptor's point of view, when I'm painting, I'm like building up layers, like literally layers of paint or of medium, and really getting a sculptural sense of the form that I'm making, whether it's literally like coming off of the canvas or, you know, I'm painting with color or angled brush strokes or something to describe the form. And when I paint, I use oil paint, but I don't paint with any oils or thinners. And I mix I mix like half a tube of white paint with marble dust. And it becomes like really thick cream cheese. And it's like amazing. You want to like eat it. It's that amazing.
It's Van Gogh's problem.
But it allows you, because the paint is so thick, it allows you to paint wet on wet, but in a very sculptural way, where you can layer these two wet applications on top of one another. And if like you can just layer them on top of each other,
like stack it up.
Yeah, as if you were like applying like stucco or like concrete or plaster to a wall. And you don't have to wait till it's dry, but you can also, you know, scratch into it. I have like a lot of different tools that I use when I paint that aren't paintbrushes, but you know, it's just this process of like building up layers in a sculptural way and then carving out, you know, an image or, you know, using a brush and blending and stuff like that. So it's a different way to paint, you know, then it's a different way, like it's not a traditional way to paint, I guess. You know, I'm not indirectly painting. You could do that, I guess, when the paint's dry, but I think it's a very like sculptural way to think about painting.
How thick are your surfaces then, if you like look at a profile?
So it really depends. I've been painting with acrylic medium, and it's a mixture of a number of different acrylic mediums, but you know, they can come off the canvas like a few inches, or they can be like totally flat on the canvas or a panel or whatever. But basically, like when I was working with tar my second year of fellowship, I can't remember, I was building up like these thick applications of roofing cement, which is basically just tar, and it was so fucking toxic. It was just like the whole floor of the academy stunk like tar, and I was like, oh my God, this is so fucked. And
did you get in trouble?
No, I put it like downstairs. There was a spray booth in the basement at the time, yeah. And I like left it in the spray booth for days, and Mike Smith was like, what are you doing, man? He was the, but so when you work with tar, you have to seal it with shellac. And I was getting these like amazing big impastos with the tar that like a week later they were dry, or I thought they were dry. And I would put the shellac on it and then oil paint on top of that. But what happened, I was using mineral spirits to like sketch out the first parts of the painting. And the mineral spirits were
dissolving
the shellac. And then I didn't know what was going on. I didn't realize it. But as I was painting, the tar would come through and stain the oil paint. It was a beautiful accident. And it was like these beautiful browns and like really dark amber colors staining the oil paint.
From behind it. Wow, that's wild.
And it was so cool because it left this kind of like ghost image of all the marks that I had made previously up until like the finished image of the painting. So there's one painting I have in my apartment that was like the first painting that survived, that didn't completely like melt away out of that process. And the way I'm using the tar now is similar, but I'm controlling it more. So I have a very thin application of tar, and then I'm basically just like rolling paint on top of it. And I use these different tools to kind of scratch into the oil paint.
I've seen those. Those are almost like an etching or something.
Yeah, they feel like etchings, and it feels like you're carving into like flesh almost.
Hmm. Those are beautiful, very sensitive.
And so, yeah, those, whatever mark you make ends up breaking the shellac barrier. And what happens is my process, I'm just like constantly mark making and covering things up with the paint and rolling over my previous lines. So all the previous lines like come through and stain the image Marshall and form this like ghost image.
Wow.
And it's interesting to me because
I didn't know how those are done.
Yeah, it's a really exciting process for me because there's a constant discovery in, you know, I leave the studio and it looks one way and then I come back a day later and it's like totally different.
That's so cool.
And it's almost like you're working with this living, breathing thing that will change over time, you know, as it ages. And I think there's something really beautiful about that. And I think that kind of aspect of time also plays an important role in like all of my other work, even the birds. I mean,
mm-hmm.
They're not weatherproofed and, you know, they're going to age and decay over time. And that kind of ephemerality has always been a part of my work. I think that's like the one constant thing that's like throughout my work is its relation to time.
It's kind of, this is such a weird analogy, but I was like listening to this thing about dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And how they know what dinosaurs, like a lot of the footprints look like, which is sort of like something I never really thought about, but like a dinosaur would step on the earth, it would create a crevice, and then that would somehow, whatever, get filled with something.
Yeah.
The fill would harden. And now in like England, these hardened footprints are reemerging to the top of the surface.
That's so,
cool. So they're like, look at all these old like dinosaur footprints. It's like the crazy. It's like that process though, that underdrawing coming back up to the top.
Yeah, and I think it's just nice to think about like a piece of art that kind of like changes and ages as you do.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it more than like just something you hang on your wall. You really start to like live with it and notice it. And, you know, the tar stuff, after a certain amount of years, it'll stabilize and it won't really change that much. But, you know, it kind of like starts to patina in its own unique way. And it shows the process of the image and like the struggle that happened to find that image. And, you know, I think, going back to like the whole painting is an artifice thing, this might be a way for me to kind of like get around that, where it's like I'm showing you every single thing I did to this painting. Mm-hmm. So it's like no longer an artifice.
Right. You're like an archaeologist.
I'm glad you brought that back up because I wanted to, what did bother you so much about the artifice? Was it that it's a deception? Do you feel like it's a lie? Like, what is it?
Yeah, I think like coupled with like, my whole thesis research and stuff, I just felt like that being lied to was the worst thing you could do. And I didn't want to lie. I didn't want my artwork to lie to anybody. And it seems ridiculous for me to think that, you know, creating a photorealistic painting would be such a big deal for me at the time. But for some reason, it was just like, I'm not going to do that, you know, because it doesn't feel like true to what I want to express. So I think that I didn't realize it at the time, but like that's what was going on kind of in my mind. And, you know, it caused me to go in this whole different direction and kind of focus more on like the materiality of things. But, you know, going back to it, it's like I still want to create images. But how do I do that in a way that, you know, feels, one, I guess, new and like more exploratory to me, but two, that I'm kind of showing my process to the viewer.
Honestly.
But not to say that other types of painting are like a lie. It's just the way Vince put it at the time, I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? You know, like when teachers say something that all of a sudden is so profound to you and it just like changes everything. It was just one of those moments where I was like, I just looked at everything I was doing in the studio and I was like, I can't do this anymore.
Hmm.
Wow. I want to come back to something else too. You're saying, you know, playing with all these materials, you're looking for something foreign, something fresh, something weird that you haven't maybe played around with. You're also talking about excavating, revealing in an honest way what you've done, letting that show through, even to the surface level. What was beneath that? What was beneath that? And there's this element of accident, and I'm wondering if that word resonates with you in terms of a technical narrative.
See, I used to not like believe in accidents, right? I mean, I think I was setting things up that might cause accidents, but that I was setting things up in a way like kind of controlling the outcome, like controlling the accident in a way. Mm. You know, like the tar drawings and like the mark making thing, like, yes, the previous marks bleeding through is an accident, but I'm setting the environment for the accident. So like, I know that's going to happen.
It's like mm-hmm. controlled.
It's kind of like accident. A controlled accident. I'm, you know, I think when I first started using that material, I had no idea what I was doing. So like, yeah, everything ended up being an accident, but, I think kind of like refining that accident and learning to use it in a way that's like beneficial to your practice is, maybe like, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but maybe it's a way to make them not accidents anymore, to actually like bring them as a part of, you know, your studio practice and like turn them into a real technique. Mm-hmm. You know, but
'cause an accident isn't really reproducible at some level.
Yeah.
Like it's so unsustainable to rely on accidents.
Yeah. But like the way I was cutting wood for the birds, right? I'm cutting all these irregular shapes that I'm literally just like cutting stuff, mm-hmm. right? I'm not like...
It's so repetitive.
Yeah, but I'm like cutting this angle and I'm like cutting down this way. And then I find all the pieces on the floor and then I find one that fits. So like every cut is like an accident.
Mm.
But I'm just finding the accidents that work, I guess.
So you that's a literally how you would do it. You would have a pile of sort of feathers on the floor and find the yeah. right one and put it in.
For certain feathers, they're more stylized. They have like the beveled edge and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. for a lot of the feathers on the body, it's just like I'm literally just like spending 3 hours cutting the pallet down, cutting like 50 pallets down, and then taking all the pieces. And whichever ones fit, I'm using those.
Wow. It's pretty cool. I mean, that's so intimately involved with these things, like from breaking a pallet down of choosing the right piece to putting it in the right spot. Like,
yeah,
that's pretty far from the idea of an architect on that way. That's a total.
There's a certain amount reactor. Of trust, right? Mm-hmm. A trust in that uncertainty. In the unknown, that you're going to take the next logical step with whatever's available, kind of providing yourself with
yeah.
those accidents.
I mean, I think it was a process that was kind of like tried and true. I mean, it's the same process that I used for Goliath and another sculpture after that. But it's also just the material. Like, I wouldn't be able to do that with metal or stone or ceramic or anything like that, you know? Mm-hmm. It's trust in the material.
That's an incredible thing. I think that spans across all of your work. Yeah. Trust in the material, an intimate trust in it.
I could see that.
Trust in yourself too.
Yeah, but you know, you have to remember that most of what I'm doing is like failing mm-hmm. at whatever I'm making, right? So the whole fellowship year at the academy, I made sculptures that were like went to shit.
Me too.
I mean, that garbage. Body of work in the show was from literally like 3 months earlier. Mm-hmm. I had spent the whole year making things that I threw away.
I just finished painting over my last fellowship painting. There's 15 paintings I had to get rid of.
And even the work from the show I ended up destroying and turning into something else. So
that's nice.
You know, I think the only way the birds were successful the way that they were is because I had failed so many times to make a sculpture before then that, like, I finally got some process right where I knew it would work.
Well, that's so important for listeners to hear that idea of all of it is collected experience, collected data that you're, you know, like, just because, I mean, Sophie, it sounds like you made 15 decent prime canvases to go back over.
Yeah, some really interesting textures in it.
Interesting oil prime canvases.
I fucking made those stretcher bars.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't throw those away.
Yeah, I rabbit skin glued linen. Holy I'm not shit. Throwing that shit away.
No. Oh, my God. That's a process. So you also said something I want to touch back on, too, about the different art you create out of different sort of emotional states, anger, calm, whatever. What is your favorite place to work from?
Ooh, do you, that's a good question.
I like being calm.
You like being calm?
It's a lot less like emotionally tolling. Like all the tar drawings come from a very calm,
they seem that way.
Calm place. Hmm. Like in a chair. You know, they're smaller scale, so I'm not sweating. I'm not, like, moving around that much. They're very intimate and more subdued. But, you know, I have this kind of, like, love-hate relationship with making art. You know, I love making art, but I also, it makes me so frustrated. Like, I could have the best day in the studio and be like on the top of the fucking world, right? Like, and I'm sure you guys have felt this, but it's like nothing could be wrong in the world when you feel like that. And then literally in one brushstroke, your whole mood can fucking change. And it's like, I'm fucking out of here. Like, this is fucked. I'm giving up my studio. I'm not doing this anymore. And that really takes a toll on me.
It's so true.
You know, I've always been like that. Like, growing up, I would make all these drawings and, like, hang them up all over my room. And then something would happen. I'd be mad at somebody or whatever, having a fight with my brother or whatever. And I'd go and rip every single fucking drawing off the wall and, like, rip them up and, you know, be so dramatic about it. And, but
that, Joe Cometti.
I've always been like that. And I always remember, like, one of the things Wade said to me was that, like, it's always going to be like this. You know, there's going to be this, like, wave curve in terms of your life as an artist. Like, you're going to be up and you're going to be down. And you basically just have to remember, like, when you're on your way down, it's going to go back up again. Mm-hmm. And also, when you're, like, on top of the world, know that you're going to go down again. So, but that's the part I really hate about it. Like, I feel art's the only thing that makes me feel unstable. But it's also the only thing that, you know, really makes me feel like I have a purpose, or, like, really gives me that, like, sense of life. Mm. And it's just, it's so bizarre that you can feel like that from, like, a painting or from making a painting or a sculpture. And it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's all, like, it's all your choice, and you're just doing it sort of like.
Yeah.
You've constructed, like, this horrible puzzle.
Nobody's asking you to do this. It's just like, go relax, have a beer. And I'm just like, I can't, you know, I feel bad sometimes for, like, my wife, because I'll be in the worst fucking mood and I'll just be like, I don't want to talk to anybody. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to go out. And I'm just, like, so pissed because I had, like, a shitty day in the studio, but it's not really that big of a deal.
I'm scared of it, honestly. Like, I think it's feelings I've had for a long time. It became a little clear in Kyle's interview when she was like, it's so brave to be an artist. And I thought of art as, like, a little more kind of for elite, and I don't see that as very brave and all this sort of stuff. And I'm like, but then talking like this, and it has been all-consuming in my life for a long time.
Yeah.
And I always sort of think, God, think of all the things I've missed out on or lost because of just doing this wacky thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's pretty daunting looking back, you know, for me, probably like 20 years on this thing, and just being like,
it has taken a lot from me.
Yeah, and I think you really have to like love doing it. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you wouldn't, and you wouldn't sacrifice, you know, everything just to do it. Mm-hmm. But I also think that artists, you know, across the board are like the most resilient group of people.
Yeah.
Ever.
Absolutely.
You
know,
I mean, you could spend 60 years of your life doing this one thing without any like real reward, or you could fail every day in the studio or whatever it is. I think that artists just like keep going on, and they keep finding a way to do whatever they want to do.
I was just reading about Henry Darger, and he got he was definitely on that path of just doing this thing.
Yeah.
And then he was in the hospital, like dying, and a guy he rented the apartment from found all of his drawings as they were like clearing it out, knowing that he was dying.
Yeah.
And then a nurse was like, or I think the landlord came over and was like, "Hey, we found some really remarkable stuff here." And the guy knew about art and was like, "I'm going to try to
quality." You know,
he knew about quality for sure. And he's like, "I'm going to try to, sell this stuff." And his answer was, "It's too late now." Like,
little did he know.
Yeah, exactly. But like, that was a pursuit of something, and it was too late to sort of help his life out at all. You know, yeah. Just like, it's pretty wild. That's pretty brave, actually, to just do that.
Yeah, I think that's, I think there's like some level of quality in doing that, and just doing it and not really giving a fuck about like any commercial success or if anybody even sees it, you know. Uh-huh. So you're doing it solely for yourself. I think there's something really kind of beautiful in that.
I really romanticize those guys who do that, whether it's fine art or music or anything. Those are the guys I tend to really appreciate.
But then, like, what do you do for your day job? You know?
It's like Bukowski sorted mail all day. Yeah.
Like, oh, my God. Oh, shit.
This Harper thing. Lee, she had a desk job. It's just like, wow.
I had a desk job, actually. I was a paralegal for like almost 5 years.
Oh, really?
This
oh,
is before I went to the academy.
You told me that, and then you walked by the school and you saw inside. And you're like,
I gotta get to this story. So tell me the whole thing.
So after college, me and my buddy moved to Brooklyn, and I started working for this this commercial artist. He was like he had a glass and stone studio in Gowanus. It was an amazing job, and he fired me like after 3 months. And I was like, fuck, man. Like, what am I going to do now? And I couldn't find a job for like 6 weeks. And I got a temporary like legal assistant paralegal job. And I was really only supposed to stay there for like 6 months or something. And I ended up staying there for 4.5 years.
Wow.
But during that 4.5 years, one day I was out. So this is another kind of side story, sad story. My older brother has a really good friend whose dad has a property management business. And there was a building in Tribeca that was vacant. And we convinced my friend's dad to allow us all to live in the vacant building if we paid like a nominal amount of rent.
Okay.
So it was a 6-story building. It was a block away from...
Oh, for God's sake.
It was above Bubby's.
I forgot about that beautiful detail.
That was like one of the best periods of my life. But so my brother's friend moved in there in like January. My older brother and I were living in the tiniest fucking apartment in New York in the East Village. My room was so small, I could lay on my bed and touch all four corners of my room. Like, no joke. God. I could just turn my light switch off when I was laying in bed. And so I was still a paralegal. And we had these, like, scumbag landlords that were totally ripping us off. And I'm like, fuck, we need to break our lease. Like, we need to get out of here. We need to move into this building in Tribeca. And so we took them to small claims court because they never gave me a signed lease back, but also they overcharged us for the move-in rent, and they wouldn't give us back our deposit or whatever.
Yeah, deposit.
So we go to small claims court, and I'm like, I'm a paralegal. I can represent us. And small claims court is like a fucking mess if you've ever been to New York. But we go, and like, they never came up with a lease. They couldn't find like any signed document for us. And the judge was like, so you don't have a lease? And the landlord was like, no, we don't. But
they appeared in court?
Yeah.
Without anything?
Yeah, I mean, it's small claims court. Like, you can just go and whatever. But anyway, the judge ended up allowing us to break the lease because we effectively had no lease, but we had to split the deposit with them. Okay. So we're like, all right, fuck it, let's do it. Anyway, we moved into this building, and we filled the entire building with... Each floor was like a different group of friends.
Oh, my God.
So we were only supposed to be there for like a maximum of 6 months, and I ended up living there for like 3 years, a little over three
years. Whoa.
And it was the best time of my life. Like, I had... Me and my brother shared like 2,500 square feet of the top floor of this building in Tribeca. And like, it had a country kitchen and like skylights, and there was a roof, and it was like, God. The building was falling apart, but my room is big enough where I could have a studio. And that's like when I started painting again. And when we moved into that building, I walked on Franklin Street. I walked by the Academy, and I saw this big Jenny Saville poster, and it was like continuing education classes or whatever. And I started taking CE classes at night. Wow. For like three semesters before I applied to the grad program. So while I was a paralegal, I was working during the day, and then I was taking night classes and weekend classes at the Academy. But, you know, before then, like, I had no space to make work, and I didn't really know any. My friend from college was an artist, but he and I were the only artists that I knew in the city, really. And, you know, I decided that, like, going back to grad school was something I wanted to do. So I took CE classes and then finally got into the grad program. But yeah, that building was just like insane.
Wow.
It was one of like those New York moments that happened like once in a lifetime. And it was just, it was amazing. But
yeah. And people listening to this might not know, Tribeca is like probably the ritziest area in New York City. Like, the,
we were paying like nothing to live there, and across the street, there was like a little for rent sign. It was at the whole floor of this like identical building across the street. And we called up one day just to like see how much it was. And it was like 20 grand for the floor. And we were like, oh my God, we're never leaving this place. But eventually we got kicked out. But
that's crazy.
Yeah, it was like so cool. But I think without that place, I probably wouldn't have been like, I definitely wouldn't have had room to make work. I was trying to make work before that, but it's like, you need some type of space. Like, I was usually living with like two other people and in a really small apartment, and I just like couldn't get my shit together to make anything. But
yeah,
in this place I had like a little alcove for my studio, and like that was all I needed, so it was good. But anyway, the paralegal job was also kind of a blessing in disguise, because it's allowed me now to be comfortable like reading a contract, writing a contract in terms of like an agreement and understanding a contract. And I think that's something that like you absolutely need to do, especially if you're working like public art or something, or even like, you know, if you're making a commission for somebody, like you need to have that experience.
Yeah. And also they talk about how
the
like
business side of art, like, you know, is really important. They don't often teach it that much.
Yeah, oh, I know nothing about it.
Yeah, I don't really know anything about it. I just know how to read a contract, so I think I know something about it.
I had one, I remember I was excited about this gallery show, and it had like this crazy contract to it. Yeah. And I'm reading, and it looked like they owned your soul for like 2 years, you know?
Yeah.
And I was showing it to one of my friends who knew the gallery, and he's like flipping through, and he's like, you know what? That gallery has no money. Like, just sign it. They're not going to hire a lawyer to come get you.
That's good to know. Some insider information.
Right. So I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, maybe that's how you just do stuff.
Holy shit.
I was reading this book about Frank Auerbach's life.
Hmm.
Love to know what you think about Frank Auerbach, but he was friends with Freud and Bacon.
Yeah.
These 67, he was making some great work, and
yeah,
Freud was talking to him about his drawings, and he said to Frank, there's the difference between a painting from a photograph. He's talking about how important that distinction was. He said it's the degree to which feelings can enter into the transaction from both sides.
That's cool. Is he talking about,
like, when you take a photo, it's 1 second.
Yeah.
But when you're painting, it's very sustained. There's so much time for parts of you to be embedded into that image. And then on the same end, when it's done, the viewer can enter as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious what you think of that.
Yeah, I mean, I stopped using photography as a source material, I think, when I was in school and going through that whole artifice thing. But I don't think that necessarily, like, painting from life or imagination automatically has more feeling than a painting from a photograph.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's really up to the artist to realize, like, the tools that they're using and to use them, you know, in a way where you're not just, like, a machine, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when I make my own work and I use photographic source material, I'm not thinking as much about what I'm doing in terms of, like, I don't have, like, that emotional connection as well as when I'm making something that, like, I don't really know what it's going to be yet. I don't have the image, like, in front of me. So my emotional connection to the piece is a little different than if I'm painting from, like, a photograph.
It's almost like what you were talking about with honoring a schematic for your birds.
Yeah.
Or just kind of winging it as you go. Like, I think that's the drawback to working from photo. The end product is sitting there, essentially, if that's what you're going for. You yeah. know?
Winging it.
Winging it. I know.
Good one. Good one. But, you know, I think it's up to the artist to really, like, get over that hurdle. And
yeah, it's all up to the artist.
To be cognizant of what they're doing.
You'll see the most lifeless things painted from life and really really beautiful things painted from photo. It doesn't matter. It's just whoever's doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's really what you as an artist, like, put into what you're doing. I think that's really going to determine, like, mm-hmm. how successful your painting is or how much of an emotional connection your viewer can have, you know.
Who said that in the book?
Freud said it to Frank. He was after a remark about quality.
Uh-huh.
Like, quality is more important, more valuable than style.
That's interesting because they both have such a unique style.
I can't imagine you could tell the difference between Freud painting from a photo or from life, right?
Oh.
I don't know if you'd really notice much.
Yeah.
It would just look like it went through this Freud filter,
yeah.
no matter what it is. Like the Photoshop Freud filter.
Oh, shit.
Chalky, distorted, beautiful somehow.
Planes. A lot of planes.
Yeah. So what do you think is the most rewarding part about being an artist?
Marshall wants a reason to be happy for his studio practice. Please help me, I'm drowning.
Oh, birds are becoming extinct, the water's rising.
God. I don't know. I think one of the most rewarding things might be just that I have somewhere where I can go and do whatever I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And not have to follow any rules and not have to, you know, have any plans necessarily of what I want to do. I just have this space where I can go and like be totally free.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody telling me what to do. Like, I'm not reporting to anybody, whatever. You know, I think the byproduct of that is like making artwork that inspires people or making things that people like. But I think maybe it comes down to just being selfish. That like, this is, and I'm talking about the studio, this is your space,
mm-hmm.
and like only yours.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're sharing it with somebody, like that half of the studio is yours and you're the ruler of that place. I think that's pretty cool, and not many people have that.
Yeah.
Like really have that.
I love it.
Thanks, I love
for
that.
Saying that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When something leaves the studio and goes out into the world,
it's are dead.
You are you that invested in the reaction to it?
Yes and no. I mean, I really feel like when something leaves the studio, it's totally out of my hands. It's like mm-hmm. they're gone. I don't know. I read some article that had like mixed reviews about the birds, and I was like, eh, fuck it, like who cares? I mean, people are going to like things and people aren't going to like things. I think as long as I feel like true to the work and I feel like I gave it everything that I had,
mm-hmm.
I'm okay with whatever reaction it gets.
You want some mixed reviews though.
Yeah, I mean, mixed reviews are good.
But like when I look at a movie, I'm like the Rotten Tomatoes to know what if I want to watch it or not.
Yeah.
Like hundreds, 98s. It's like sort of bullshit a lot of times. And then the low ones are bad. You kind of want to be in the 70s, low 80s yeah. to know it's a good movie.
I love that.
It's so true though. Like if everybody loves something, it's terrible.
Yeah. That's true. But yeah, I think, you know, when something leaves the studio, I don't think that much about it.
Mm-hmm. I don't either.
I think you're you're not really responsible for it after. You know, so I don't really put that much effort into it after.
If someone went out of their way to contact you and tell you that your work had truly offended them and gave you 5-paragraph essay about how and why, would you assume any
somebody
level
did
of
that
responsibility
with yours?
No, I'm thinking about the Emmett Till painting.
Oh yeah, okay.
I mean, this is like birds are fucking way different than that.
of course.
No, I had somebody that was really offended by the work. I didn't end up responding to them because it kind of wasn't my place to, but I would respond to them, yeah, but you know, also people love to complain about shit, and I don't know, the person didn't approve of this sculpture because, you know, they thought it was like ugly and was dangerous and all this stuff, but
dangerous how?
Talking about a Goliath sculpture?
No, I'm talking about one of the birds. Like, it was just this thing that came up and
dangerous to the public.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, I would respond to them. I'm always interested to hear like why people feel a certain way, but that's kind of the point of public art also. I mean, if it's not going to be like a lobby piece, it's going to mix, you know, provide some mixed feelings for people. And I think that's kind of what public art is supposed to do. Like, mm-hmm. not everybody's going to like it. First of all, it's going to make you think about art at least once in your life or like once in your day. So that's like kind of amazing. And mm-hmm. it's occupying a space, obviously, in your life where like you're confronted with it. And I think that's kind of the point of public art. It's not only to be like this beautiful thing that everyone's going to appreciate. Mm-hmm. You know, it's supposed to be like, be talked about. It's supposed to provide some kind of discourse.
Yeah.
Even if it's negative, I mean, at least you're talking about it.
it sounds weird, but I don't have to agree with anything to appreciate its existence.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, I was talking to someone recently and they were like, yeah, but you were like reading Marx and Ayn Rand at the same time and liking both. It's like, yeah, who doesn't? Like, I don't read an idea and be like, well, that's bad for this. Or it's just like, oh, that's a cool idea. You know, yeah, it's like, yeah. It all, I don't know if it just all feels a little too theoretical to me or something, or yeah. I just like people doing things and I'll sort of absorb it and reckon with it. You know?
Yeah. I mean, if you walk right by it, it's pretty meaningless. So if it gets a reaction, good or bad, at least it gets a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I appreciate every reaction I get, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, nobody's like picketing against the birds.
I'm going to do that walk. I want to see them all and walk the whole way. Yeah, you should.
It's like an epic. There's a big gap between 120 or 117th and 139th because of the train tracks and all that stuff. But yeah, it's a big walk.
It's all basically on the west side.
Yeah, you can just go right up Broadway.
Oh, that's right, because it's on Broadway, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, Nick, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I hope
thanks
that was
so much.
Good interview.
It was great.
Yeah, cool.
Definitely.
Awesome.
Who do you wait? One last question before you turn that off. Oh, we should do those quick questions too. What artist do you like currently? Like, who do you look at?
Some artists that like I'm always looking at. I mean, Humbaba's work is like at the top of the pedestal for me.
Humbaba.
Yeah, please tell me you know her. Oh my God, I told you to look at her last time we met.
Sounds familiar.
I think what she does with material is just like on another level.
She do sculptures like
she makes sculptures too. But she had a couple of pieces on the Met rooftop, I think like 2 years ago. And I think she shows at Salon 94.
She did that big, I saw that on the Met roof, the almost totem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you spell it?
H-U-M-A is her first name. And then her last name is B-H-A-B-H-A. But yeah, she works a lot in metal, but she works with like cork and foam and a lot of found recycled material. Her earlier work is like all these found kind of like objects put together. But her ability to merge material and narrative is like unparalleled. I look a lot at Thomas Halsago, who's another sculptor who I think uses material in a really simple but like beautiful kind of profound way. You know, sculptures are usually made of like one material, plaster or wood, but they're also very like kind of totemic and ancient looking. I think I'm drawn to that kind
totemic.
Of more that style a little bit more, but I like David Altman's work is like mind bending. Monica Cook's work is amazing. Who else?
How do you spell Thomas's last name?
House ago.
So you mainly look at sculptors.
I look at a lot of painters too. I mean,
oh shit, this stuff's amazing.
Like the early, or the when I first was when I was younger and I like first started like having my eyes open to the art world. I saw the Glitter and Doom exhibition at the Met.
Yeah.
2007.
That was great.
Remember that? That was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
And the Weimar Republic painters, and I just like fell in love with all of those painters. And just their ability to like interpret socially what was going on and, you know, the war and everything was just like amazing. So when I first started, I looked at a lot of those artists, but
yeah, Glitter and Doom was great.
I think I do maybe look at sculptors more. It's just kind of hard because I mostly see artwork on my phone now.
And unfortunately,
it's just like looking at a painting this big is like just not doing it for me anymore.
I know that we have that conversation here all the time. Can a painting on Instagram really do anything? Like, it's at the point where it can't elicit any feelings from me.
No.
Even like whatever they would be, like joy or jealousy or envy, it's just like boring. It's weird.
I've become mixing with ads too. Trying to sell you shit.
I've become so numb to it. I'm just like flipping through shit, and you know, I'll look like on my search feed and the image is even smaller. I'm like, oh, that looks cool. And I click on it. I'm like, oh, this is fucking bullshit.
There's also one other fun bonus question I've been asking people. And I know you're doing more sculpture now, but you're still very much painting.
I want to ask a bonus question too.
Okay.
Two bonus questions.
Maybe we'll come up with it. Do you think ultramarine blue is a warm or cool color?
Whoa.
Stop.
I love it. We're going to do it to everyone.
All right.
I would say it's more warm.
Warm?
Yeah.
Okay.
Am I right?
We don't know. No one knows.
I think it's more warm. Doesn't it like lean towards green?
I think it leans a little more towards purple on the wheel.
Okay.
Like a cerulean leans a little more towards the green, usually. But I will say most people answer it warm, like you did.
Cool.
Which is interesting to me.
What's your bonus question?
What makes a great painting?
Oh, yeah. That is
a great painting. I think if it embodies like most of the things that we were talking about, I think a really great painting elicits like an emotional response from the viewer. Mm-hmm. And I have only experienced that maybe 3 times in my life where like I've been stopped dead in my tracks from a painting.
Okay.
And something happens where it's like every cell in your body is just like jumping out into that painting. And like I've almost been brought to tears from these experiences. And like, that's only happened maybe 3 times in my life.
Do you remember?
Which painting?
I remember one of the paintings was when I was in college at Vermont. It was a faculty show. I forget her name. She was an adjunct faculty, but she had this enormous charcoal drawing. And it was like she was on top of this giant sphere, this like squishy giant trash bag sphere, and she was just like either crushing it or like getting sucked into it, but something happened where I was like, oh my god, this is it.
Oh, that's awesome. I love it that it's like a not an art historical one too,
you know. No, it was totally,
it's so great.
And then when I went to the Vatican for the first time in St. Peter's, just walking into that place, I was floored. And I was just like bawling immediately. I never cry, by the way. Like, I haven't cried in like years. But when I went there, I was just like, boom.
Really?
It was just so overwhelming. I don't know what it was, but
architecture too.
Yeah, just everything and like the scale of it and just how the fuck, first of all, how the fuck did they even make that? Like, how do you put those sculptures at the top, right? Have you guys been there?
Mm-hmm.
The sculptures at the top, those giant figures in stone.
Yeah, marble. Yeah.
How do they put those on the facade?
Right.
Like back then when it was built. Like how...
They didn't have the cranes they have in the
How
town
do you do
now.
That?
Yeah.
They're like 5 times life size. I'm like just floored by the scale of everything. But just walking in there was really a profound experience. I'm not religious, but I really felt like some kind of weight walking in there.
Jason Vogel's like
he's really into that term secular awe for art that I like a lot. It has okay. that kind of feel to it, you know?
Yeah. And I think there was one other, but I can't remember right now. But yeah, it's just, I think the best works of art do that to people. And they, you know, can't really, like, people crying in front of a Rothko. Mm-hmm. I also think it has to do with, like, contemporary life at the time and personally, individually, how you're feeling and stuff like that. But but that can happen, like, from any work of art, really. It doesn't have to be in the Vatican or, you know, you could just be walking by, like, some college faculty show and be totally floored.
I love that.
Yeah.
So you think it's like when who wasn't on here that said when a genius is when an artist becomes most like themselves?
Thelonious Monk, George Delancey.
Oh yeah, Thelonious Monk, right?
What did he say? A bass player in here, a jazz bassist.
Cool.
And
quoting Thelonious Monk.
A Monk quote was, "A genius is becoming most like yourself in your art." You know,
that's cool.
I like that idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
Quality. Just gonna get in there one more time.
I feel like we've got like so many big terms going around that I don't think we've understood tonight. Like quality, beauty, all synthesizing to make these undoubtedly profound moments, but it is really hard to put your finger on what that is.
Yeah. Because you know, it can be a fleeting thing. You know, the third time I went to St. Peter's, I didn't feel that way.
Right.
Mm.
You know?
Over it. Mm. Just kidding.
Yeah, I mean,
boy,
I had been there before, got all my crying out, you know.
You're not going to give me this time, St. Peter.
Now I can see my eyes are full of water.
But yeah, it's like, I think it's also, you know, there's a big variable in like where you are in that moment in time. But I also think like the greatest works of art are ones that you keep going back to and you keep kind of discovering new things, either about the painting or maybe the artist or yourself or whatever. But it's something that keeps you coming back, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like there are certain things when you go to the museum that you go to again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you don't know why, but like you just keep going back.
I like things that kind of like you mentioned Rothko, and I'm such a fan of his.
Mm. Yeah.
But it was so outside of my wheelhouse. I was very academic, very just like wanting to draw the right proportions and stuff yeah. like that. And so I run through the museum just looking at paintings that sort of reinforce my idea of that or had appreciation for that. And then all of a sudden, like, the Rothkos were kind of undeniable, and I still really appreciate that kind of magic trick to just open me up a little bit. Like,
yeah,
that's a square. Like, how am I feeling all this off that?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
He says he thinks about time a lot as well.
Rothko? Mm-hmm. And the layers, you mean? Like, exposed time through the layers? Is that... Or just...
I think... Not only through the layers of making it, but sustained as a viewer.
Oh, to hold
time.
You there.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, that goes back to our earlier conversation we had about a great composition isn't necessarily rhythms. It just holds you looking at it.
Mm-hmm. Over and over again.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, Nicholas, thanks so much.
Thank you both.
Thanks.
This was great.
Thanks.
Hello, listeners. This is your host, Sophia Kayafis. I just wanted to let you know that we have a phone number now. We have a voicemail, official Art Grind voicemail, where you can call us and tell us how you're feeling and what you're making during your stay in the bunker. Tell us how you feel, what you're doing, what you're up to. We'll play it at the end of the next episode. It's 929-267-4830. Again, that's 929-267-4830. All right. Go paint something.
Hi, this is Nick from Kentucky. And first of all, hope you guys are doing well and safe. But I just wanted to say that this podcast, I've been listening to it for a while now, and it has inspired me greatly as an artist myself. And I love hearing all of the episodes and all of the deep dives into the artists that I have come to know and love. So thank you, and much love and support. Peace.
Hey, Art Grind. My name is Anna, and I live in Atlanta, Georgia. My life during the pandemic has changed drastically. I'm an art teacher to 600 kindergarten through fifth grade students, and all teaching has gone online. Some of the challenges that I face are kids not having any art supplies, not having any access to technology, parents are unable to help them with their art projects at home, just the inability to have hands-on, face-to-face experiences in the art room greatly diminishes the art experience for my kids. I'm also having to balance teaching my students and teaching my third grader at home, making sure he's not behind and keeping up with his homework. In addition to being an art teacher, I'm a practicing artist. And while I've had more time at home, I've found that the stress of navigating our current situation has made creating my own art very difficult. I feel scattered and distracted, and I'm unable to find a creative place that I can paint in. I do appreciate your podcast during these times. It helps connect me to other artists, and it reminds me why we do what we do. Keep on the good work. Thanks, guys.
More sculptors, please.
Hi, I am an artist living and working in Brooklyn. I've been quarantined for the past 6 weeks. I'm losing my fucking mind.
You've been quarantined for 8 weeks.
See? Anyway, I feel like I really like your podcast. It's really cool. So keep making more podcasts for us, because basically all I can do is just listen to podcasts and paint. So that's what I'm doing. Anyway, cool podcast. Bye.